The NHL's conference finals matchups are set. It is the Canucks Hour here on Sportsnet 650, your home of the Canucks. I'm Jamie Dodd. My co-host, as always, Canucks insider Thomas Drance. Of course, you can read Drance's work at The Athletic. Canucks Hour brought to you by Avenue Machinery. Being a champion takes foresight. Build your company to win for years to come with fuel-efficient and reliable Kubota skid steers, excavators, and loaders from Avenue Machinery. Visit avenuemachinery.ca. 650-650 as well is the Dunbar Lumber text line, the smart alternative. Visit Dunbar Lumber on Bridge Street in Ladner or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. Get your thoughts, questions, concerns, whatever's on your mind, get it in. 650-650. We'll try to get to it throughout the course of this show. We'll talk lots about the conference finals, what happened in Game 7 between Carolina and New York last night, what the matchups look like. Of course, Colorado and Edmonton get going tonight. We'll talk about a little bit maybe about your night on Twitter last night, Drancer. But before we get to any of that, we reacted to it kind of live as it happened yesterday, the news of the Canucks making more changes to their hockey operations department, and really specifically to their player development department, this time adding Mikael Samuelsson and Mike Komisarek in player development roles, while also making more clear the exact roles the Sedin twins, Daniel and Henrik, will play going forward, and also kind of reiterating the roles of Cammy Granato and Ryan Johnson in the front office. And as I said, Drancer, we were kind of taking it as it happened. You know, it dropped just a few minutes into our show yesterday. And I know you have a great piece up at The Athletic, kind of digesting it all, adding some reporting. And I guess just my first question, we'll start big picture, is from our immediate reaction yesterday to now, after you've had a chance to dig into it a little bit more, what's your kind of overall perspective on what these changes tell us about the Canucks organization?
Well, when we discussed it on the program yesterday, you know, I brought up that old development coach thing. I've been harping on this for a while just because I went back to the staff directories of the Pittsburgh Penguins and trying to figure out, A, who might be hired, right? Originally, when Rutherford comes in, you always want to look for those connections, right? And also just because it's good to have a sense of exactly what his front office structure has typically looked like. And, you know, the role of development coach always stood out to me because it's not something you see typically. It's a relatively rare sort of position. It's not something that the Pittsburgh Penguins had prior to Rutherford. It's not something a lot of teams have. And so that stood out to me, and I've discussed it a few times on this program over the course of the past few months, just because I was sort of wondering if we might see something similar recreated, particularly after Rutherford spent so much time, and this isn't just lip service, this is also how he's functioning in his role as president of hockey operations, where, you know, Alvin's vision really is front and center on a lot of different matters. So what I didn't understand when we were breaking it down yesterday, though, was just how much the Twins are going to be removed from a more advisory, classical hockey operations management type role. Technically, they're still going to be in hockey operations, but they're going to be team staff in a very material way. They are going to be around the club. They're going to be eating with the players. They are going to be on the ice on occasion in both Abbotsford and Vancouver. This is a hybrid coaching player development role, which will lean a little bit more toward the coaching side, I think, at least the way I understand it. Very much so, they are the development coaches, which is not something that I would have anticipated, but it's something that came about, I think, in part because, well, no, I always say that to caption it just because it's a natural segue, but yep. I'm not thinking, I'm not guessing, I know this stuff. So they're going to be, this has come about in part because in management roles, the Twins are rookies. In a team environment where the focus is on what are the habits, what are the improvements, what are the, you know, small details in the game that we can, you know, take, twist to our advantage and help us succeed, help us win games. That's a familiar environment for them. That's something they're masters of. They know at a bone deep level. And this is a role that's going to better maximize their ability to take advantage of that. Being helpful, helping this team succeed. Like, I know it sounds corny, and if it was almost anybody else, I'd probably have a more cynical spin on it, knowing me, right? I like to slither about. I'm a bit reptilian in my own sort of gauge of human character, but with the Twins, they mean it. coming back to help this team recover from a thoroughly dreadful 2021 was the impetus for them joining this management group in the first place. Moving down from the boardroom to the locker room, effectively, although not returning to be players or anything, so I want to at least take a little spin off that ball here, is driven by the same motivation. That's where they think they can be the most helpful. And they definitely guided this. I think they definitely guided this process in a way, in part because after a year in management, seeing what they, you know, could see, getting a sense of all sides of the business, I think they really did feel like this was the part of the game that was most interesting to them. I think it was the part of the game where they felt they could have the biggest impact. And they collaborated very closely with Patrick Alvin, general manager. Yeah. Patrick Alvin, now countryman, but didn't have a pre-existing relationship prior to joining the organization. My understanding is that the Twins and Alvin have found in one another something of a kindred spirit, a shared set of values on, you know, how to go about winning games in this league, how hard it is to go about winning games in this league, the importance of having a mastery of details at all levels of the organization, of marshaling everything possible in the service of winning. I think they've found, they've built a fair bit of trust, a close relationship. And I do think Alvin certainly encouraged this direction. He definitely collaborated at length with the Twins on shaping exactly how this would go. And ultimately they've landed here, not quite part of the coaching staff, not quite part of hockey operations, but in this sort of middle ground where they can more directly influence the improvement of players, you know, even helping coaches with little tactical things, ideas, concepts. And that's going to be a fascinating spot for them, particularly because we know how cerebral these gentlemen are about the game. We know how hardworking they are. We know that Alvin has had concerns about this team's practice habits. And we know that in an era when the Twins were ascendant on this team and in that locker room, that wouldn't pass muster.
Yeah.
What's the influence going to be? I'm really fascinated to see it, but it seems like a position that makes a ton of sense for the club with where they're at right now.
There's a lot I want to unpack there with the Sedins. You mentioned the practice habits element, which I think is really fascinating. The relationship that's developed between them and Alvin is very, very interesting. Before we get into those things, you know, just at the end there, you're talking about they, to a certain degree, they still have kind of a foot in both worlds, right? In the front office world and the on-ice coaching world. And that strikes me as something that can be very valuable to kind of have that bridge between the coaching staff and the front office. And this is something we've talked about on the show. Increasingly, front offices around the NHL are more and more involved in coaching decisions, in tactical decisions, right? Like, there's a specific way they want the team to play. They want the coach to be putting players in specific situations. So I think having people like the Sedins, who are so well respected, who carry so much weight for all the obvious reasons in this organization, who have now built a relationship with the GM and are going to be able to build those relationships with the coaches and the players as well. Having guys like that in that role who can kind of shuttle ideas back and forth and make sure they're implemented, make sure everyone's on the same page from the coaching bench to the front office, I think that could be really, really valuable. The other thing that stands out to me is, okay, so you mentioned, you know, Alvin and the Sedins have kind of hit it off here, right? They formed a really good working relationship built on some kind of shared core values. And one of the things I thought was interesting was Mikael Samuelsson, who was on with Halford and Brough this morning, you can go check that out, mm-hmm. on their podcast, said, you know, he doesn't know Alvin, but it was Daniel Sedin who called him and said, hey, can I kind of put your name in the mix? So reading between the lines a little bit there basically sounds like the Sedins nominated Mikael Samuelsson and Patrick Alvin said, yeah, sure, that sounds great. So that's more evidence of that strong working relationship between the two.
He certainly got a letter of recommendation from the Twins. And you know, ultimately it was Cammy Granato and Ryan Johnson guiding this process in terms of the specific shape. What was interesting to me is Samuelsson and Komisarek joined the organization, but they're not going to be based in Vancouver.
Right.
We're not, you know, we'll see Samuelsson, I'm sure, at some organizational meetings. Always good to see him. Great sense of humor. Looks like he could step on the ice sheet tomorrow and play, right? Like, he is a beast as just like a human person. Large dude, extremely fit. Komisarek, even bigger.
Yes.
Well, and the Komisarek thing's interesting because Komisarek worked with Rutherford at the tail end of his career. He was he spent his last season with the Carolina Hurricanes. He was often injured. You know, Rutherford admires the character. I think that was really what he valued. And, you know, he saw Komisarek adjust his game in an era where skating began to take precedence, you know, and find a way to still be effective. And, you know, as you think about maximizing your potential, maximizing the potential that a player has, you know, I think they wanted that. But more than that, what I really read into with Samuelson and Komisarek joining the org is the investment in resources into player development. Non-cap spending is not something that teams are often super excited to do, right? The player salaries are the bulk of any NHL team's expenses. But the ROI of, you know, getting 20% more out of you know, four or five guys every 2 or 3 years is massive, like huge, tremendous. It's a good place to marshal and spend your resources. And what the Canucks have effectively done is built, you know, Chris Higgins was a little bit overtaxed, I think, in terms of, you know, doing the college visits, building those relationships, doing some recruiting, you know, all of his responsibilities. And what they've effectively done now is kind of split off regions for their player development personnel. So assistant director Chris Higgins, he'll sort of be based in the West. You'll have Mike Komisarek based in the East, and then you'll have Mikael Samuelson based in Europe. And that's going to be a level, like a touch point with Canucks prospects in Europe that is well outside of what this organization's had in the past. They've sort of relied on amateur scouts, including the now deceased Patrick Johnson, to kind of do some of that work over the years. But now they're going to have boots on the ground in a player development capacity in Europe, and in Sweden in particular, where they've had a ton of draft picks in recent years. A guy who knows the league, a guy who's been a member of this franchise during some of its brightest days, but also a general manager in the Allsvenskan. So makes a ton of sense and shows a commitment to this particular path that's well outside the bounds of what we've seen from this organization in recent years.
Well, it's a significant investment. And Patrick Alvin was on with Satyar Shah and Dan Riccio yesterday talking about, you know, hey, you can have the best scouting department and draft as well as you want, but it's not going to make that much of a difference unless you also develop the players correctly. And, that, you know, they're backing those words up with action and with real investment now. Just before we move on from the Sedins, right, because one of the really interesting quotes we heard early in Patrick Alvin's tenure as Vancouver Canucks general manager was talking about how the practice habits of the Canucks needs to improve. And when you think back to the Sedins and their reputation for being, you know, always the fittest players on the team, the most prepared, the most dedicated, the hardest working, for them now to be moving into this role where they're going to be, as you said, you know, eating with the players on the ice on a regular basis, constantly around the team. I think back to the Sedin jersey retirement night and when Kevin Bieksa was speaking, and one of the things he said was the Sedins built the culture of the Canucks. They played with Bo Horvat. You know, they crossed over with Brock Besser, and they are going to pass that culture on. And 10, 15, 20 years down the line, that culture will still exist because of the Sedins, right? That's what Kevin Bieksa was saying. And I don't want to say that that hasn't happened, but this seems to me like a chance for the Sedins to kind of continue that legacy, build that legacy, make sure that does actually come to fruition down the road, right? Because, you know, one of the things we always talk about is, okay, Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson, they have such high ceilings, but they also need to level up, not just on the ice, but in terms of being leaders in this organization, right? And I wonder how much of an impact the Sedins can have on that sort of thing, right? Re-emphasizing how important that culture is, how to be a leader, how to take those steps as young players. And it's hard to think of two better players. I don't think you can, who are in a better position to help the organization in that way than the Sedins.
Yeah, the only problem is that they're not playing. And it, at yep. the end of the day, is always going to be different when you're lacing them up versus anyone who's not, right? You can only have so much impact on a team's culture if you're not dressing yourself. But you know, I think you're right. There's a lot of work to be done in this area in particular. You know, the way that teams function, the way that teams welcome newcomers. I mean, one thing we've seen is a sharp adjustment period for the people who've joined the team in recent years, for example. We didn't really see that with JT Miller. Like when you had Tanev and the like around, it felt like there were more guys who'd come in and be relatively seamlessly integrated, Tanner Pearson, Josh Levo, you know, Tyler Toffoli in 2019-20. And then all of a sudden, you know, you lose some of that heft. You lose Markstrom, you lose Tanev, you lose Toffoli. All of a sudden, you know, Nate Schmidt comes in.
Yeah,
and
doesn't work out.
Doesn't work out. Like, and we saw last season, Connor Garland and Oliver Ekman-Larsson talked about it. In part, you need to groom the next generation of guys who are able to do that, to do the, you know, social coordinator thing. Now, Bo Horvat is the captain, so a lot of that ultimately revolves around him. He's still in place. He was the captain in 1922, so it's not been full changeover, but it's more than one guy. It's more than one guy. It's a team environment. And so, yeah, I think there's work to be done there, but the Twins' impact in that area, I think, is going to be limited at the end of the day. But I do think, considering the commentary that Alvin has had about practice habits, structure, you know, I do think that their appointment fits neatly within our view of what Alvin and Rutherford have communicated about their ambitions in terms of how the team goes about its business. Not results, not what they're planning to do, not rebuild versus retool, not any of that stuff, but just how you go about your business day to day, how and what it means to be a Vancouver Canuck day to day. And I do think this appointment is occurring with that very much at the front of a lot of people in the organization's minds.
Dan and Poco texts in, how much impact will the Sedin's role have on the current roster as far as coaching, or are they more for prospects? And I know there was some discussion that they'd be involved with Abbotsford as well. Do you have a sense of kind of the breakdown of responsibilities for the Sedin's, or is it just going to be kind of on an ad hoc basis, I think,
year? They're not going to be traveling, so certainly if the Canucks are on the road, they're going to be in Abbotsford.
Yeah.
They're not like day-to-day part of the staff, right? If you're not part of the traveling party, there's still a layer to which you're a bit removed. But so that I know. In terms of the exact like breakdown, or, you know, Jason Bruff asked me today what I thought they were, a day in the life would look like for them in their new role. I'm like, man, I have no idea. I squirreled the question. I was like talking about them running in the mornings and like spending time with their children. you know, so I don't know. Like, I don't know the itinerary of a Sedin day in their new role. But, you know, I don't think player development stops at the NHL level. You don't arrive at the NHL level and it's like, well, job's done.
Look at Nils Höglander. Yeah. Right? Like, and that's just one example, but everyone needs to develop more and continue developing often throughout your entire career as an NHL player.
Oh, and think about this. Think about what we saw from Vasily Podkolzin this year, right? And think about the many different routes that this could go in, right? I mean, you know, tonight we'll watch very probably McDavid be hard checked by Valeri Nichushkin, who was a top 10 overall pick, actually 10th overall, exactly like Podkolzin, and spent his first season in the NHL at 18 as a first-line player, picked by none other than Jaromír Jágr himself as the guy who reminds him the most of him, right? Like 40 points. Injuries come. He goes an entire season without scoring a goal. He washes out of the Stars organization. He ends up signing a rebuild your value 1-year deal, and now he's reinvented himself as this defensive forward. And then on the eve of free agency, the offense comes back to him for the first time in 7 years, 8 years, and now he's poised to be, you know, one of the prime assets available on the market. We say development isn't linear, but that's an example of what it can mean. Now, a lot of times we see this story. We see the guy who comes into the league with high hopes of being a star, isn't, washes out of that organization, lands elsewhere, plays a major role on a team that's really good. You know, think about Brett Connolly, you know, becoming a high-end fourth liner for the Washington Capitals. A 7th overall pick, didn't work out for Tampa Bay. You think about Andrew Cogliano out of Edmonton, or Blake Como, who, you know, sort of washed out on the New York Islanders. You think about Jeff Tambellini and the role he played in Vancouver in 2011. Like, he was a 30-point player in a depth role. He was basically their 7th top six forward. Huge impact on that team.
Manny Malhotra was a first-round pick.
Perfect example.
Right?
Malhotra, who the Rangers wouldn't trade for Pavel Bure when he was 18 years old, and ultimately had to reinvent himself as, like, the perfect third- or fourth-line center to stick around. Now, so often we hear those stories, but how often do you hear those stories and the guy spends his entire career in one spot?
Not much. No, right? It usually involves a change of scenery there,
well,
right?
Well, teams are leaving money on the table here, Right? I mean, imagine if you could set up your player development department just to mine the value that you get from the top end prospects that don't amount to anything. Right? Imagine if not amount to anything.
But don't live up to the top 15 billing, the lottery pick billing.
Right? And you think about this team, for example, like there's been a couple guys in recent years who were picked very high in the draft, who became literally nothing for this organization, right? In Jake Virtanen and Olli Juolevi. And that was trending that way, regardless of Virtanen's off-ice issues, right? He was going to be bought out no matter what, because he never figured out how to be, if he'd just been a fourth-line energy guy, you know what I mean? Like, defensively reliable enough to play on the PK and use his speed. If he'd just become, you know, like a bigger Michael Grabner, right? Which, you know, Grabner had some scintillating seasons, don't get me wrong. I don't know that Virtanen ever would have got to that level. But, like, a, you know, bottom six player who uses his speed on the PK and can be physical, huge value there. But he wasn't even going to be that. He was legitimately just an empty calories scorer and a perimeter scorer at that.
Yeah.
You think about Olli Juolevi, you know, the cost of Olli Juolevi not making it last year was bigger than people realize. You know, so many of the club's issues in the early going, I think, can be traced pretty directly to the lack of, you know, a penalty killing lefty, particularly with the way that the team wanted to play. Boudreau was able to sort of neuter that because Brad Hunt's his guy and Brad Hunt's really good. But also they started using Hughes on the PK, so that became less of an issue. But with the way that they wanted to play in the first 25 games, not having just like a third pair lefty who could, you know, play low event hockey safely for 12 minutes and kill a penalty, nothing to write home about, don't get me wrong, but if Olli Juolevi becomes Brian Allen, well, then that's real utility for this team. They'd have a 25-year-old, you know, third pair defenseman who you'd still think has some upside, who would also be an asset, a meaningful asset on the trade market. Instead, Juolevi's literally nothing. He's on his third team. He's, you know, probably going to log some minutes for some bad teams for a couple of years. Now, obviously, injuries are a big part of the story. Personality's a big part of the story. There's nurture versus nature. There's some people you can help. There's some people you can't. But the amount of inefficiency in the way that players are handled in general across the league, not just a Vancouver thing, is through the roof. And if you're able to get a small competitive edge the way that Pittsburgh and Tampa Bay in particular have over the course of the last decade by doing things differently, by spending more resources, by spending more time, that's well worth your effort. That's well worth the effort. And for the Twins, you know, I don't think it's going to be, well, we just work with Pod Colson. You know, I do think there's going to be work put in with, you know, like real established NHL level players on a regular basis. Well, and there should be.
The game is always changing, and guys who can react to that and keep developing new skills are going to do very well. And I even look at a player. Now, I don't know if the Sedins would be working with a player like this just because it's different positions and all of that, but look how Luke Shen has had to adapt, right? And learn how to fit into this NHL after being a very, very high draft pick and being expected to play a certain way early in his career. And he's adapted and he's found a way to make himself very, very valuable to the Vancouver Canucks. And that process, it really never stops. You're always trying to improve. You're always trying to get better. So I think it's a good point that, yes, the Sedins will be an incredibly valuable tool for the young players and the prospects in the organization, but they're also going to be a resource for all the players on the team, even the older ones, even the more established ones, even the very successful players who are, you know, always looking for that next edge, always looking for that next way to improve. A couple of other things I want to hit quickly here on the Vancouver Canucks, and a couple of things that you mentioned in your great piece up at The Athletic right now, Drancer. Number one, and this is a really kind of fascinating development as well, as we start to learn more about how this front office is going to function on a day-to-day level going forward, is that, and this shouldn't be any surprise when you look at her resume and how incredibly accomplished she is, but that Cammy Granato is really standing out within the organization so far for her work.
Her portfolio has been, is very large, wide-ranging. The command presence is, you know, being noted at length, both internally and honestly around the industry. There's a sense of it. And, you know, her departments have seen the most change in some ways. You know, the pro scouting side, which she oversees, has been relatively untouched. And yet I still think there's a sense that things are being done very differently within that department in terms of top-down communication, instruction, work being done on undefining terms, the level of support that director Brett Henning and the rank and file are sort of receiving there. Same story on the amateur side. And it's interesting because she's really sort of emerged as kind of the key player personnel functionary, which was, of course, Derek Clancy's area of expertise, mm-hmm. Another assistant general manager. And that's not to say that there's, anything like any there. I'm not implying any discord or anything, but I think it's emerged as an interesting split where, Granato's administration has kind of come to the fore. She's kind of the administrator, and Clancy's emerged sort of as the club's chief set of eyes in a way to this point. Now, things are going to change as these people, learn to work together, figure out their lanes, figure out how to support one another. But my understanding of it anyway is that's sort of how it's emerged to this point, which, not a surprise to me, but certainly because Clancy was the first hire and because of his background as a director of player personnel, I sort of expected it to go one way. It's kind of gone in a direction that I find pretty fascinating, pretty interesting. And additionally, Cammy's overseeing the player development department. Her fingerprints are all over the moves we saw today. And of course, the changes that we saw in amateur scouting a little while ago. So her departments, her portfolio is emerging as being very vast and has undergone a ton of change. Just recently, just in the past month. And certainly her ability as an administrator, the work ethic, I think it's becoming very clear that she's got the trust and the ear of both Rutherford and Alvin. And, we'll sort of see where this goes as everyone, feels each other out and begins to try and win in the boardroom in a way that might eventually translate onto the ice at Rogers Arena.
Well, and it's interesting that she's in charge of the player development department because that's where they're making big investments this week, right? And they're putting a lot of emphasis on that. So that is an extremely important role for them. And I think the fact that they have her in that position speaks volumes about the trust and the confidence that they have in Camia Granato, which again, if you know anything about Camia Granato and her career prior to being hired by the Canucks, should not come as any great surprise. Just a couple of more quick Canucks notes to get into on the other side. We will do that. We will take your text 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. Plus, we will look ahead to the NHL's conference finals matchups. The Western Conference Finals gets going tonight. Very, very excited for that. We'll talk about both series on the other side. You've got it on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to the Canucks Hour, Sportsnet 650, your home of the Canucks. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here with you for another segment. Canucks Hour brought to you by Avenue Machinery. Being a champion takes foresight. Build your company to win for years to come with fuel-efficient and reliable Kubota skid steers.
I'm trying to check something on my phone, and the Top Gun trailer is auto-playing.
Let me finish the read.
On Natural Stat Trick. Come on. Come on, Top Gun.
And loaders from Avenue Machinery. Visit avenuemachinery.ca.
You've already got my money. Stop this.
Nothing worse than autoplay. Nothing worse than autoplay.
Disaster. I was just trying to look something up about the Carolina Rangers series because I thought we had to talk.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're going to get into it.
We have to talk about anything can't happen or whether anything can happen.
Yep. For those of you...
I'm told that it can.
For those
I'm
of you...
I'm told that it can, but I don't believe it.
Not on Twitter. And, as I always say, congratulations on making smart life decisions for those of you not on Twitter.
Congratulations on logging off.
Yes, exactly. May we all be so lucky someday. Yeah, Drance got it was your turn, and this happens. Everyone who puts out sports takes, it's going to come for you eventually, right? Your turn on the old takes exposed. I don't know what to call it. Your turn in the old takes exposed barrel, I guess, right? It was your turn to take your lumps on Twitter last night because of a tweet you had put out when I think both Edmonton and the Rangers were losing their series in this second round. And then, of course, both teams advanced to the conference finals, and people were having some fun with that last
night. I was just watching the game, and I just watched the Carolina Hurricanes dismantle the Rangers, and then I'm watching the Flames get the first 7 scoring chances and score 2 goals and take a 2-0 lead. My observation is like, oh boy, the you know, this is not going to go well. And of course, my priors are that I expected Carolina to win.
Yep.
And make relatively quick work of the Rangers, which didn't happen. And I expected the Flames to eventually beat the Oilers, but I thought that would be a long series. Wrong on both counts. And anyway, I decided to tweak those people who've been disagreeing with me about the anything can happen or anything can't happen. So I want to rewind here. The rules, I have a few rules. I'm eventually going to write them down, but I have a few hockey rules, right? One of them is there's no such thing as an untradeable contract, right? That's one of my rules.
Sure.
Another one of my rules is hope is not a strategy. That's another one of my crucial rules. Here's a third one of my rules. A third one of my rules is winning in the NHL is not a passive activity, right? And then here, my fourth rule. So I'm beginning to make my list. My fourth rule is anything can't happen. And the anything can't happen rule suggests that while we all know that any team can win one game, right? Arizona can beat Colorado multiple times over the course of this past season, right? While anything can happen over one game or one series or even over multiple series, to win a Stanley Cup, you need to maintain a high level of play for 25 games. Only elite teams are capable of it. And thus, you cannot just win and win the cup. You might win a round. You might win a round or two. You might even get to the conference final. Hey, you might even win the conference final. But eventually you're bumping into an elite team, and the cruel gravity of your non-eliteness will overcome you, and you will not win. That's my theory. And the Rangers and the Edmonton Oilers. Now, let's be clear here. These are not Cinderellas.
No.
By any stretch of the imagination. The Rangers are a 104-point team. The Rangers are a 110-point team. They have home ice against the Tampa Bay Lightning. And the Oilers are a 104-point team with maybe the best skater to ever grace this earth, this planet. But I don't consider them elite teams. I really don't. It's for the Rangers, it's the 5-on-5 structure. I don't think they have enough of a fastball there. For the Oilers, it's the goaltending and it's the defense core. Woodcroft has given them an extra gear 5-on-5, but I don't think it's enough. I don't think it's going to be enough against the Avs. That said, I didn't think it would be enough against the Kings, and I definitely didn't think it would be enough against the Flames. So take that with a grain of salt. What I like about this hot take is that it touches a nerve. We've been told that Cinderellas happen. We root for Cinderellas. When I posited this theory to Bruce Boudreau last week, I thought he gave, as Boudreau often does, like the best humanist response, which is, no, I think you have to be elite to win the cup, but if you can be the team that does it, oh boy, don't we all want to see that? The romance of it all. And it's like, of course, Boudreau hits it out of the park, right? He knows exactly what we want as sports consumers, which is the underdog story. It's just that winning in the NHL isn't a passive activity. You need to be an elite team at the end of the day to hoist the cup. And for the most part, the teams that we pinpoint as Cinderellas are elite teams that started slow, usually for percentage-driven reasons. Shooting percentage in the case of the 2012 Los Angeles Kings, save percentage in the case of the 2019 St. Louis Blues. So what I like about this take, though, is that I believe it, first of all.
That's always good. A good start.
Helps to have a hot take that you truly believe in, like strongly. I believe that you need to build an elite team to win the cup. I believe that the teams that set the playoff bar as their ambition are doomed to fall well beneath it. I think you need to be trying to get a championship just to be in the playoff mix every year. It's just too hard a league to aim lower than the very apex, than winning four consecutive playoff series in any given year. That has to be your sole focus as a hockey team if you're going to have any success in this hard-capped league. So I like it because I believe it. I also like it because I think it makes you think, like, whether you are agreeing or disagreeing, at the end of the day, we're engaged in a conversation that, first of all, lasts for 2.5 months, which is great because it's like something you can argue about throughout the playoffs. But it makes you think and forces you to think about what winning hockey looks like and what matters as you get higher and higher up the summit, right? I often talk about that pyramid of things that matter, and at the very top of that pyramid is obviously a Stanley Cup, and the next level down is like building an elite team, and the next level down is, you know, winning in the regular season, and then the next level down, and you go all the way down until you're at things like practice habits, things like consistently identifying players who help you control play. it makes you think about what actually matters in this game, and that's the type of conversation that I want to have. That's the type of hot take I want to have. Instead of the usual hockey hot takes where it's like, hey, this team that has already lost was fundamentally flawed. Like, that's the majority of them, and that's a safe spot to be. You're not going to be on Old Takes Exposed if you're saying stuff like that. Anyway, the rule of this was never about a team like the Oilers or a team like the Rangers not being able to get to the conference final. Of course, they were going to be able to potentially weasel their way through a couple of series. In the Rangers' case, with a hearty dose of luck. In the Oilers' case, because I genuinely think they've played remarkable hockey and they've got Connor McDavid at the absolute top of his game, doing things we've almost never seen in the Stanley Cup playoffs, breaking the game to his will in a way that's, you know, must-watch TV. I'm not going to miss that game night.
Oh, no.
So, well, at least not the first part. I might go to the C's game. So, but I'm certainly going to watch the first couple periods. With all of that said, I think this touches a nerve because we do want to believe that, you know, the team wearing our favorite laundry is capable of, you know, getting there and quickly, right? We do all want to believe this. So it touches a nerve, and I understand that. But the basic tenet of this take remains. All it requires to be proven is one of Tampa Bay or Colorado to win the cup. You can get 5-1 odds on either the Rangers or the... Do you know the Avs today are almost even money to win the cup?
It's outrageous.
Plus 105? Plus 105!
Yeah.
So you know who else doesn't think anything can happen? Vegas. Just putting it out there. And we'll see what the Western Conference Final brings. I'm picking Avs in 5. I'm picking Lightning in 6. Big shocker. I think we're going to get an all-elite Stanley Cup Final, which will hopefully put this to bed without me sweating for another month, as I'm loath to do, or as I'm always doing when I make these takes. Perhaps I've manifested an Oilers-Rangers Stanley Cup Final, as one of my industry contacts suggested to me the other day. But, you know, I don't think I have that kind of power. I think the Avs are going to be too much. I think the Lightning are going to be too much for the Rangers. And I think I'm just going to scribble out the final 8. Like my tweet that ended up on Old Takes Exposed has final 8. I'm just going to scribble out the 8, put in 4.
There you go.
And drop it.
There you go.
Once these series are over.
I'm going to make the ultimate coward's picks for these series, which is I'm going to take the favorites in 6 games in both of them. So Lightning in 6, in Colorado in 6. The least spicy, controversial, or brave picks you can ever make in an NHL playoff series. But there you go. That's what I'll take. And, you know, my thing on the, oh, can anything happen or do you have to be an elite team debate has always been, why are you looking for a reason to lower your standards, right? Because even if you believe that it is possible for a kind of deeply flawed non-elite team to get hot and go on a run and win the Stanley Cup, I think everyone agrees that your chances are a whole lot better if you're an elite team, right? So again, even if you think the answer is, hey, if you get that, you know, the Bruce Boudreau, oh, wouldn't it be great to have the romanticism of the underdog run? Even if you believe in the possibility of that, I don't think anyone thinks it's a true crapshoot, right? Where teams 1 through 16 in the Stanley Cup playoffs all have the same chance of winning the Stanley Cup. I think everyone understands that if you can be a more elite team, you have a better chance of winning. So that's where it's always kind of come down for me is, well, why not just try to make your team better, right? Like, why not aim higher? You're still going to increase your chances at winning the Stanley Cup. And this tweet came in from Abu Amar Taze5 on Twitter. He says, winning a playoff round or two is still something, especially if you're a young team. Playoff failures are needed to win a cup too. And
not sniffing at that, by the way. Agreed.
Yes,
right.
I agree. And it's again, we had this discussion with, you know, comparing the Canucks to Nashville and, you know, what difference does being on one side or the other of the playoff bubble make? It's not that, you know, this playoff run has no meaning for Edmonton or New York if they get knocked out in this round. It's just a question of where you put your priorities and what you're ultimately trying to build towards, right? And that you can't let yourself get distracted by the hope of finishing 6th or 7th or 8th and going on a run because your goalie wins you a couple of series or because your best player goes supernova and wins you a couple of series, right? That shouldn't be the goal. It's no problem. It's great. Hey, the fans get to celebrate if you go on this run to the conference finals. It's great experience for the players. It can help get you buy-in the organization. All of that is absolutely true. You just can't let it distract you from the things that need to improve with your team. So for me, it's all about where you set your priorities and where you set your goal. And the goal should still be to try to build an elite regular season team, because that is going to give you the best chance ultimately of winning the Stanley Cup.
It all flows from there, right? Again, the pyramid's not a concept that's should be hard to understand. Like, it all flows from at the bottom end, and you can disagree with what you value at the bottom end. You can have stylistic differences. There's various ways to win in this league. You can value goaltending more than you value defense. You can value, you know, a 1 and a 2 and a 3C, like building down the middle, above having an elite winger, although I think you need an offensive, you know, you need someone who can score when you need Marian Gaborik. You can't be too structurally sound that you don't need Marian Gaborik, to use the 2014 Kings as an example, right? You still need that game breaker, in my view. But you can quibble over exactly what the composition of, you know, the base of the pyramid is. But the top of it's a Stanley Cup, and the next layer down is building an elite team. And you don't really get to the cup without that. And if you want to be the exception that proves the rule, well, you're tilting at a windmill. You're tilting at a windmill. This isn't... We had that great text in last week, which I think we need to come back to. This isn't rocket science. It's hockey. Some of what results in teams being great is common sense. Some of it's complicated, right? Some of it's a little bit counterintuitive. Some of it is, hey, you can lose a trade very, very badly and it still be a net positive for your team because of the, you know, vagaries of the hard cap era. Three teams that were relatively recently, like last 3-4 years, lottery regulars, have lost trades badly in the last few years that still helped them build the teams that we saw in the playoffs this year. I think about like the Tyler Toffoli trade that the Los Angeles Kings made. Tyler Toffoli is better than John Madden in a second round pick still. What did I say?
John Madden.
Oh yeah, John Madden's really good. Tyler Madden, excuse me. You know, Tyler Toffoli would still help that Kings team today, right? Especially at the clip that he ended up signing at. He'd probably be more helpful for that team than the second and the third they got. That said, they had the picks to spare, or they because of that trade, they had the picks to spare to do the Arvidsson trade. They had the cap space they needed to do the Deneau signing, right? They improved materially because of the cap flexibility that they were able to carve out as a result of moving on, not just from Toffoli, but the whole host of players who are about to become expensive or already are, that the Kings moved off from, whether it's Tanner Pearson, whether it's Jake Muzzin, whether it's Alec Martinez, whether it's Tyler Toffoli, on and on down the list. They still kept their core. They've still built around sort of the key pieces of that golden era. Quick, Doughty, Dustin Brown's just retiring now. Kopitar is still there. But everyone else, they jettisoned everyone else, and they lost that Toffoli deal. And yet, the Kings clearly got the better end of it than Vancouver did, even though they got the better player at a cost that we'd now look at and say, hey, that's really low. Look at it. Toffoli went for 50% more 18 yep. months later. Like, that's selling low on a guy, ultimately. But the Kings won a trade they lost. The Florida Panthers won the Trocheck trade in a lot of ways, even though they lost it. Right? They got nothing of meaningful value back. Chase Prisky's probably the best player they got back in that deal. And Prisky's a Group 6 UFA. He's probably not re-signing there. So that's another example. They got four players. I guess Luis Duranen is the best player for them. But, you know, they got four players that are effectively nothing for that team. Trocheck's a difference-making top six centerman. And yet, because of how they invested that cap space in Verhaeghe, in Duclair, because of what they did on the margins in the wake of that deal, they won that trade. The Colorado Avalanche are my final example. The Ryan O'Reilly trade. Zadorov and Grigorenko, disaster. And yet, that trade, in the big picture, set them on a course to restock so quickly with trades that involved Stastny, Duchesne, O'Reilly. They rebuilt their organization by being willing to move on and by being really smart about how they committed that cap space. And yeah, nailing some top 10 picks too. So those are the complicated things. But for the most part, this isn't rocket science, it's hockey. The best moves are sometimes the obvious ones. And that's got major ramifications for a Canucks team that I think is facing some really difficult series of factors here going into this offseason in particular, a very expensive blue line with term committed that's not good enough, right? You've got not just a four, like, you know, the forward group, you like the forward group, you like the offensive skills here, but because of how they structured things with Pettersson, they don't have the benefit of cost certainty. So you're in an environment where you're the Canucks, where say things hit the way you want to and everyone plays, you know, really well, and you get more out of all of these guys, and Podkolzin continues to grow and Pettersson continues to grow. Like, your best possible example, your rosiest circumstance for this Boudreau-led Canucks team. Okay, well then, Besser's getting raised this summer, Horvat and Miller and Hoglander next summer, and then Podkolzin and Pettersson the year after. So you've got this blue line that's too expensive and the price is going up. You've got a forward group that you like, but is about to all get more expensive at the same time. And within that sort of cost constraint, that cost pressure that you're going to be navigating like clockwork year after year, you also don't have enough cheap labor coming. Like, you don't have enough of a prospect system to fill in the gaps. And you're going to have a really tough time keeping it together. So even if this works at this point, like, even if you are a dyed-in-the-wool believer that this team is ready to be the Rangers, right? They're a move away from the Rangers, and they're going to make that move this summer. That's your opinion. I get it, but they still aren't going to have the flexibility with all of that rose-colored circumstances that we're talking about to meaningfully upgrade the supporting cast. So in that environment, difficult decisions are going to have to be made, and they might have to be made even if the right blue chip, right-handed defenseman that you all crave isn't necessarily available in how they decide to navigate, you know, some of the potential deals involving core forwards and potentially top four defensemen. Cap flexibility is going to need to be carved out one way or another, or the organization's going to have to be the most efficient club in the league by a mile finding ELC talent over the next few years, despite not bottoming out and despite not having really landed a high impact college or European free agent to this point in the signing season. Good luck. That's a complicated task at hand.
By the way, we were talking about your tweet getting featured on Old Takes Exposed. Now I guess I'm catching strays here from the listeners in the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line, because Saskatchewan Joe says, remember when Jamie said Tyler Myers is a legit top four defenseman? All due respect, I completely disagree. So my old takes are getting dredged up. But he was a legit top four defenseman. I stand by that.
He's a top pair defenseman
this
season. I stand
by that. Yeah, he was the matchup role. I don't know. Sometime this season, I can only imagine. I mean, whatever. Listen, I barely remember what I say on this show half
Tyler
the time.
Myers is fine. The problem is paid as 1A, right? Yes. That's the problem. It's not anything else. Myers is a good person, can log minutes. And by the way, I think he might actually have positive trade value if you decided to move him this summer. But I don't think the organization's going to do that. I don't see them thinking that that's a replaceable piece or that this is the time to make that move. But I actually think Myers is at a point where, well, and here's the other thing. Last thing on Myers really quickly. The Tampa Bay Lightning, the beast defense core that they've built, if they win a third one, I guarantee you Tyler Myers will have positive value.
Interesting, just because of the size factor. I like it. They're very, very, very interesting. We will get into that and more tomorrow. I'll continue to look ahead to the conference finals. The People Show, Bick Nizar, Randy Bjanda is up next. It's the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.